Accession number 10165, reel number 52.
Martin McLean, reel 52. You were telling me this story the Sergeant Williams told you about snakes on the troop ship.
And this ship's officer came down, who's a naval officer, who is the go-between between the army and the ship's staff. And he came down and says, "What's this about a python aboard?" And he was told the story. He says, "Right, captain wants to see you. Egg dumb with the python." Egg dumb means right now in him. So up he goes, carrying the kid bag on his shoulder with a snake, python. And he's hauled before the captain, and the captain berates him, no bother on the deck. He says, "Get rid of it, get her overboard now." And word went around that people knew what was happening, that he's going to sling the python overboard. And two of them, he gets a hold of the head and somebody gets a hold of the body and the tail. And he says, 1, 2, 3, over. And over went the python in the water. And its head came up just like a periscope of a submarine, looked around and started swimming away. And just the curiosity, I said, "Would it ever reach land?" He says, "A python would reach land all right. It would fight even somebody mentioned the case about sharks. He says it would fight a shark. He says it'd get land if it's within its swimming distance. It'll get there." So the general uproar from the lads, "Yeah, you so-and-so liar, and this is the best story I've heard, but by what a lot of codswallop it is." He started laughing. He says, "Please yourself." He says, "I've told you the story." About a fortnight later on, we got a new sergeant major from the Oxen Brookes Light Infantry. And he joined our company where we used to go up for a cup of tea, and we're always yarning about funny things that happened. And he says, "The funniest thing I saw was a man, a sergeant of the commandos, who had a python aboard HMS Delwara. And he told us the story exactly as that lad told us." And the lad went away for his court-martial, and he was tried, and he was reduced to corporal. Now, I got a job going around recruiting for the Territorial Army. I had a mobile column. I was travelling all around Hampshire, Sussex, Kent, you name it, all around the South Country, setting up the show for recruiting for the TA. And once I stopped at Borden Camp for to harbour the vehicles, fill them up, and to have a night's rest. And who did I bump in but this Corporal Williams and his striped PT instructor's jersey. And he laughed as he says, you wouldn't believe about the snakes, would you?" I said, "Well, it was convinced to us." He says, "Come with me." And he takes us into an education centre they had in this place, and he had two big glass tanks full of ferns, and he starts tapping on the glass, and two viper heads comes up, and he picks one out. He says, "That's a viper, that's poisonous. Have a look at it." He says, "That's poisonous." He says, "Watch this." And he puts his hand in another one. A handful of grass snakes, all entwined with each other, and the heads were coming out hissing. You know, and I was horrified at them, but still, he just showed his hand, and he says, "I'm telling you," he says, "now what happened about the snakes?" He says, "The one I lost, it gone. The other three I sold to London Zoo." He says, "I got a good price for the two members because of the man and woman, male and female." He says, "The python I got a good price for." He says, "Now, I worked at the London Zoo." Confirming this story many years later on, sitting on television again, David Allen was on, and he's introducing a man who's an expert on snakes. And who should come on there but Williams in his white coat, a little pointed goatee beard now, and he was the man from the London Zoo in charge of the snakes, and he's describing how to take venom out of snakes and all this. The same man, so his story must have been true.
What were you doing at Borden Camp?
The fact is that the regiment now had no 2nd Battalion, and they'd made Borden Camp a holding unit for all the light infantry groups. That's all battalions of the light infantry. And there was very serious rumours going around that we were going to form up a light infantry brigade, or light infantry group, they weren't quite sure of the name at the time, of all light infantry together, instead of being in a brigade where you had heavy infantry, or infantry, and light infantry, they're now going to be brigaded. I don't know what the reason was for, but it turned out that it was mainly for recruiting purposes. Because Durham being a good recruiting area, the men having joined the Durhams wouldn't transfer to the Duke of Cornwall's light infantry who lived in the south of the country. And they wanted to stay with their own regiment because they all spoke the same tongue. There's lots of rumours going on about this. Now, at the same time, boarding camp is just an unemployment exchange or employment exchange. All these WOs and sergeants returning from leaves, returning from battalions, returning from all over the country, returning from regiments and units folding up and disbanding through the war, now standing around, waiting around, looking for jobs. It was the job of the unit itself to provide jobs for you. I got to know that there was no posting for me until I'd been shadow ranked. Now, this is another thing that we didn't know about. First of all, there was Light Infantry Brigade Group we knew nothing about. We'd been overseas so long, and we didn't know about the shadow rank. And what it was is I was called for an interview with a Major Crosswaite, who was a DLI major, who'd been a prisoner of war the whole of the war. And he started questioning me about when I obtained promotion, how I obtained promotion. And then I told him that I'd received accelerated promotion in the 2nd Battalion DLI in March 1940. And that then risen to Sergeant Major and what have you, and served as Sergeant Major the whole of the war. And he wanted to know all my background, my history, which I told him. And then he told me the story. He says, well, sad to say, he says, we've got a job, a place in everyone, in a true position of seniority on the roll as pre-war. And he says, you may have to come down rank, which means that I may come down to sergeant. Well, I was very upset at this, the thought of it alone. And we start talking about a certain particular man, Joe Dobson, who was a sergeant with me in France. He was the MT sergeant. And he was apparently seen at me, came. There was no consideration given for the fact that I'd been given accelerated promotion over Dobson, although he was a senior sergeant at me, and colour sergeants, the lot. I'd been jumped up from a sergeant to platoon sergeant major, which I thought was very good. I was reputed to be, and the old Paddy Richards, who's died recently, always used to call me the youngest sergeant major in the British Army, which I was at the time. I was just about 27, 28, and a sergeant major in the infantry battalions mainly were old men. Men had done lots of years service in India and all over the world. And for me to get this promotion, I even got it above senior CQMSs, that's colour sergeants, the man that looks up the Q side of a company, and all these people who objected to me getting it, but I still got it. Well, anyway, I was told that there was a serious possibility of me having to come down two sergeants, and that Sergeant Dobson would be placed above me in order of seniority. Well, I objected strenuously to this, because Dobson had been a prisoner of war, and not only him, but other names mentioned. But this lad's name sticks out in particular. I objected very strenuously to this in the way of arguments with a discussion with a major, and I thought it was very, very wrong for a man who'd been sitting in his backside in a prisoner of war camp, roughing it, no doubt, but not having a portion of the rough time that we were having in fighting or in jungles of Burma and all the things that we went through to gain a victory for the British. I got nowhere with this argument, because I found that Dobson was eventually promoted senior to me, a senior sergeant major, and I still retained the rank of sergeant major. But the chances were, on the complete reorganisation of it, I'd have to come down to sergeant, which, if that had been the case, I would have made immediate application to leave the army, because I thought it was very unfair. At the Light Infantry Depot, once this interview was open, at this boarding camp, the holding unit, I was then told that now I had been interviewed and sorted out for me rank. They had a job in mind for us, and I was posted to Fenham Barracks at Newcastle as Garrison Sergeant Major. I was retaining my rank in this case, and so they asked me if I'd care for to go on this job. Well, I jumped at the job, because the wife was living in Newcastle, wasn't she? And things don't like fall like that into your lap every day in the week. So certainly I'll go there. Well, this was my third tour of duty at the depot. I'd been there as a young soldier. I'd been there as a Lance Corporal instructor. And now I was there as Garrison Sergeant Major.
What rank was that equivalent to, an RSM? Or?
No, that was a WO2. It wasn't RSM. No, I'd come down from RSM to WO2 because, as I said, I didn't have 11 months, didn't have 12 months service in.
So that was the equivalent of Company Sergeant Major?
Company Sergeant Major, yes. I was sent to this place at Fenham Barracks where I took over a huge crowd of nondescript people, Royal Army Service Corps, mainly dealing with Russians, Royal Army Service Corps dealing with vehicles, pools of vehicles, you know, and all sorts of odd bodies of that nature.
Was the DLI's depot now at Bransworth, or had it come back to Fenham?
No, the DLI depot was at Bransworth, but that was even folding up. There was talk of it closing down. We didn't know what was happening. Now, imagine our predicament, like to me, for instance. Whereas we had quite a lot of battalions during the war, and we had the 1st and 2nd regular battalions. They disbanded the 2nd battalion. Now there was only the 1st battalion that was overseas, and they were the only chance of getting a post back to your regiment to maintain the old ties, to maintain the old standard of what you joined for, infantry, was to get the 1st battalion. But this was impossible because those people who had finished their time in the 1st battalion and opted to finish the army, they were quickly replaced by people who had been sitting back in England on cushy jobs. I say this without any fear or contradiction. Some people had been overseas and done their tour of duty back in England, you know, they'd done the rest, and these options come up and they took them to go to the 1st battalion. Others who'd been sitting in depots and cushy numbers jumped to get now with the 1st battalion because they knew that it was going to be that or wander around like we were, unemployed. This Fenham Barracks job turned out...
When did you arrive there? What, do you remember? I know you're a bit vague on dates this time.
Yes, I am vague on dates. But it would be about 1947-48, around about that time. The job entailed really was looking after the odds and sods of the garrison, people who are on there on compassionate portions, and working with the garrison adjutant in general, maintaining a bit of discipline in the camp. But you couldn't maintain this discipline because everybody had this idea if the war was finished, we wanted to be out of it. But I used to shake them up quite a lot. We had a number of people from the Royal Engineers, from the Black Watch, from all people, who were posted to Fenham Barracks on compassionate grounds, family troubles, and they were the garrison police. And this garrison police we held one of the barrack room, one of the guard rooms at Fenham Barracks, the old one that I used to know when I was a young recruit. In the meantime, they built another one opposite us, full of the red caps. They were doing garrison duties in the city, in Newcastle. Coming to us in quite a large number was deserters being rounded up, people who had gone absconded the whole of the war. And we had a lot of them. Some gave no bother at all. Others were objection. We had one tough nut who came from the Big Lamp area in Westcote Road, Newcastle. His name just goes for a button at the moment. He caused an awful lot of trouble in the guard room. For instance, he ranted and raved about being locked up. He'd been deserted for about 3 years, this lad. And he got into his cell, and how the blazes, he pulled his bolted bed, a bed that's bolted to the ground, a wooden plank of beds, which was in the old detention barracks, going back years. He pulled it off the ground and jammed himself into the cell and wouldn't let anybody in. And he was rambling and breaking the cell up, breaking windows and everything. We didn't know what to do with him. I didn't know how far I could step in a way of using force on a prisoner. I'd never had this involvement before. If he could got in and got a hold of his arms and pinion down, yes, we could have done that. But as far as using force on a prisoner, I didn't know. So I went across to see the military police sergeant across the road about the matter. I said, can you give me some advice on this? He says, oh, he's locked himself, leave it to me, he says. So he got some of his red caps, and I was short-staffed at the time because the men were working shift work. And they have a big fire reel, a hose pipe, which they run out in the case of fire. He had the police run it out and attach it to a hydrant, and he got the nozzle. Well, in the cell door, there's a little hole, eye hole, which you can't block up. It's open all the time. And he put the nozzle of this pipe in there, and don't forget, it was winter. And he squirted this water into this lad, full force, and gave him a good drowning. He says, switch off. And he went on for half an hour, and then he put it on again, flood this lad out. He done it about three times, this lad came out drenched and soaking. Anyway, that night, some of his crowd came to try to get him out of the guard room. And I wasn't there at the time because I used to go home at night time. And I And fortunately, one of the other lads on compassionate person saw what was happening, nipped out the guardroom, crossed the road to the military police, and the military police came in and stopped what was going to be a breakout by force with these, the TAMS they called the people, the TAMS, T-A-M-S, still a very noted bad crowd in Newcastle.
Were they civilians? Or
they were civilians. They were all in civilian clothing. They could have been ex-servicemen, deserters like he was, because they were all of the same kin. Anyway, their attack was broken up. Another time, this one became noticed throughout the whole of England. There was another lad, a gypsy. He'd been absent the whole of the war, 5 years. They picked him up and brought him into Fenham Barracks and dumped him. And one night, a corporal in the Royal Engineers was guard commander, and also my compassionate persons were there doing night duty on the patrol in the area, locking the gates, ensuring nobody got into the barracks, etc., or trying to. It was a huge area to patrol. And this lad, a woman came to the guard room with two children and asked if she could see Mr. So-and-so. And they said, well, you're not supposed to see him with the children. And she pleaded, yeah, well, they're not my children, blah, blah, and we really must speak to them. They let this man see the children in the guard room across the big six-foot table, and the forms, the wooden forms, which is normal furniture for the guard room. And the woman and him had a bit chat. And then the woman got up to go out in a very short while, and he reached over and grabbed the two children by the hand. And he says, right now, Tara Mabel, or whatever her name was, and off she went and left the two children. The men grabbed her to bring her back to get the children. She says, they're not my children. And there's no way could we get these children off the man. So I was sent for. I was at home, and up I come. And I said, the only answer to that is, we have a big detention cell, which houses quite a lot of people who are brought in on arrest charges from the city by the military police, or deserters, anything of that description. So I cleared everybody out of there and put them into single cells, and we put blankets on the big detention cell bottom, on the wooden bed, same as what I described, but a huge one, this one. And so they got on to sleep. In the meantime, I'd been on to Gareth Nadgett and told him the situation. And he was down there to first light to see what had happened. And he's an oldest man. He was too old for war, but he was very concerned about these two children in the guard room. But unbeknownst to us, it was a set of plan. This woman phoned the Daily Mirror and phoned the local papers about the two children being held in the guard room. And in no time, reporters were getting up the guard room and with their cameras to take photographs, asking to see the prisoner, asking to see this. And I forbid anyone to let anyone past the guard room gate or into the guard room at all to take any photographs. We got on to the medical officer, who was a great old scout. He was the man that examined me when I first joined the army. And we asked him if he could give this man something in his food so he'd go unconscious and we'd get the children off him. He wouldn't have no dealings with him, but he'd come up to see the man, try to get the children off him, and the more anyone went near him, he got hold of these two children's frail wrists as if he'd break them. A lot of concern was going on about this now. The civilian police were called in to see what they could do about the children. Up came an inspector of police and a couple of policemen, and a policewoman, and they tried to get the children off him. No way. The more they went towards him, the more he gripped the children's things. This went on for some time, and always, every time the barrack gates opened, the news reporters were trying to get in. They had photographs of the men going in and out the guard room, the police going in and out the guard room, appearing on the front pages of all the local newspapers now, mainly the Daily Mirror. So the police and I and the adjutant had a talk, and the police inspector said, is there another way into barracks? I told him there's another entrance which is locked at the bottom. We could open it. He says, right, we'll go off. We'll push off in the vehicle. And he says, and I'll shout you that we'll have to get somebody else to come and have a look into this before anything else. And then he says, I'll scoot round the back, bring the car in the back way, shut the door, keep everybody out. Now, a short while after we get in, a policeman will appear and they clear all the photographers from the gate, where it was just big steel gates where they could see through. which he did. And he said, now, once that they've got this, the people that get out from the gate, he says, bring our prisoner down to the adjutant's office, which the adjutant and I said, discuss, bring him down to the adjutant's office. Down we come with him and the two children, me and two policemen and myself. We get him in the office, and the police really tried to force the children off him, and the policeman, the inspector says, no dice, no can I do. So this bloke started calling me, and I called him, because we'd give him no pleasure at all being in the guard room, but treat him like a real criminal, and we give him the hard work, and he wasn't getting the sympathy he wanted off me. He started calling me in the guard, in front of his police. So at that time I saw a loophole whereby maybe we could get the children off him. And I was never frightened of him, because being a tough infantry sergeant major, you'd gone through it and you were muscle bound and you could take on anything. Unarmed combat, a lot. So I started provoking this man, and he was going to clout me. I said, go on, go on. And I went up to him, he dropped the children's hands, and he went to go at me, and the police grabbed the children and away with them. And that's how they got them off him. And I had the job of escorting this man once again under strict security. The police, the photographers now knew the children had been released. This woman must have told them. They weren't in touch about the whole lot. They weren't in photographs, they weren't information. And our men had been forbidden to give any encouragement to them whatever. And I was given an instruction next morning I would personally convey this man down to an army punishment station in Staffordshire. I do forget the name of it, so it was a well-known place for hard criminals. What I had to do was get up, get the prisoner ready at 5 o'clock in the morning. An army lorry would show up with the military police. They'd convey him down to Central Station. They'd convey him and put him onto a guards van that would be specially put onto the train for that purpose. And there I'd escort that man in handcuffs down to this, I think it was Staley Bridge, I'm not sure, in Staffordshire way, or down that way somewhere. You'd never believe it, I had my own escort of men, and this prisoner was talking to them about me. And they told them actually where I lived. You'd hardly believe it. This lad mustn't like me, so he says, if this bloke gets out, you sort the sergeant major up. So this man got on to me about knowing where I live when he got out, or if he broke away, he'd certainly come and look me up and give us a hiding. I said, you had your chance of giving me a hiding, but any time for you, cadet, any time now in here, we'll have a hiding. And he sat down in his corner. In fact, if he'd start fighting with me and I'd fought with him, I'd been in trouble, because a man under escort, and one hand was handcuffed. And the other one was to the guard van. We got him down to this camp, and that was the end of that. But this hue and cry went on in the papers for quite a long time.
Were they his children? What was the background?
Yes, they were his children. He was a gypsy. He was living down in Walker, Newcastle. And I don't know whether the police had just found out where he lived, or he'd been on the move, but they grabbed him and got the military police, and they came and collected him from their cells and brought him into our cells.
So, Fenham, you were just running the guard, you know, and that sort of basic administrative duty?
Yes.
And how long were you there for?
I was there for about 9 months. I had some funny run-ins because, again, I thought a lot of the soldiers who had been robbed of rations. Maybe I shouldn't say this.
How were they being robbed of rations?
They weren't getting suppers for the guard because they were all men who are supposed to be living out, you know. But when a man's on 24-hour guard, he's entitled to a meal from the guard room, or meals from the guard room, married or not. I was having difficulty getting good food for the men because the cookhouses closed up. There was very few people staying in the barracks, get it this way. Even the local people, the Royal Army Service Corps food people, the people in charge of all the rations, the officers' mess people, they seemed to be all drifting out of barracks before tea and going home. I don't know whether they were living local or what it was, but they were drifting out. So the cooks used to drift off as well and leave no supper for the guard, for the men that was doing 24-hour duty. Well, the normal custom is when a man goes on guard, he's supplied with sufficient dry tea and sugar and milk to keep the guard in tea overnight. And also they get a supper, a decent supper, to tide them over the 24 hours or the under breakfast next morning. But this wasn't happening. There was a crowd of civilians working for the Royal Army Service Corps food depot. And they were going out every night, and they seemed to be carrying huge sacks of stuff. So once I got the regimental police, the military, our regimental police, they said, we stop everybody going out today, because to take food out in the army was a crime. It was a crime. And we stopped, it was a weekend, it was Saturday, stopping everybody going out, and the civilians were saying, you got no control over us. You let me out. I said, no, you're in military barracks. He says, if you don't let me know what's in your kit that you're taking out, I shall send for the civilian police, because you're on civilian WD property, and we'll sort this matter out between us. Well, reluctantly, they start turning the packs out. You've got to consider there's about 30 or quite a few more of these men going in and out, and women. And I was getting pounds of butter, pounds of cheese, bacon, meat, and all sorts of them. So I confiscated all, marked it off, and put it aside in their little groups, put it in the detention cell. And then out come the staff sergeant. He was a gribbig 6 foot man, heavy man. I know his name, but I won't mention his name in this case. And he was leaning over to one side with one of his packs he had slung over his side. So I said, in here, staff sergeant. And of course, I got the usual slaver. You got no authority over me, this, that, and the other. I said, sergeant, you apparently don't know much about the army. I said, I know my army inside out, and I know rules and regulations. Turn your kit out. I'm not, you've got no, I said, I'll give you 3 warnings. I said, the first one is this. You fail to turn out your kit, you hesitate to obey an order. The second one is refusing to obey an order. The third time is you're going to close arrest. You're going one of them cells with the prisoners, and you'll stay there. So reluctantly, he turned his kit out. You should have seen what he was taking out. Well, cutting a long story short, we got better rations for the men after that. And I explained my case. But a peculiar part of it is that I was sent for on the Monday morning. And there also been incidents with lorry loads of coal going out the depot and that shouldn't have gone out. It was all severely rationed. We had a job to get coal for our heating for the fires, I mean anything else. And the adjutant sent for me and told me I was being too officious. I should turn a blind eye to all of these things that's going on. And I disagreed with him because I was still a true and perfect regular soldier. We had words on this matter, and so I was given a more or less a direct order to turn a blind eye to everybody but the garrison duties, which I did do. And we got looked after from there on. But everybody passing the guard room used to look askance at us, you know, scowling at us, hating us. All the people got their butter and their stuff back. Don't ask me how or why, but there was a racket going on there somewhere that I was too junior a man for the break up. From Fenham Barracks, we had quite a number of prisoners, which I won't deal on, funny people. I got then returned back to my own 4th Horde Battalion after a while. I'd been there 9 months, and the whole of the depot was closing down. So there's
they
no
were back at the camp.
They'd moved from Sedgefield camp. They're now at Bedlington. The garrison police were folding up as a job. You could say that because it was now coming under the control of the 4th Holland Battalion, the unit which was the Durham Light Infantry and the Duke of Wellington's at the 4th Holland Battalion. But they were putting their own WO in, a person being prisoner of war, and I went back to 4th Holland Battalion. I must say at this stage, I was glad to get rid of the job because it was a scruffy sort of a job. It wasn't my sort of line of soldiering. A man that wants to be a policeman in charge of detention men, fair enough, like a provost sergeant, not me. I was too active a man for to be involved with that. I went back to the 4th Holland Battalion. I wasn't there very long, and then I got shoved off to a prisoner of war camp in Newtown, St. Boswell's. I didn't know what all this was about, so I got my marching orders, took my kit, spicked and spanned myself up as smart as I could. We didn't used to have very good KD, not KD, battle dress them days. It was difficult to get changes of clothing, but I used to crease my clothing, polish my shoes and look as smart as I could. And away I went up to Newtown, St. Boswell's. And first of all, I had to report to the commanding officer at Kelso, and he told me I was to take over this prisoner of war camp. and explained the situation, that the sergeant in charge was leaving, finishing the army, and that I had to take over. Now, this is where the first little stroke of Sawanko comes into action. Sawanko was a name that we'd heard mentioned quite a lot about in the when we were waiting of jobs, but what it meant was surplus warrant officers and sergeants and corporals, etc., could be employed at a junior rank. A sergeant major could be employed as a sergeant, and a sergeant employed as a corporal as a private soldier on these different vacancies that were coming up.